Ne me laisse pas l'aimer. Pourtant c'est lui que tu veux, c'est pas l'aimer. Et tu m'oublies.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. And a note to listeners that we are going to talk about the existence of sex in this segment. The truth is that few people tend to feel normal when it comes to sex. The author and philosopher Alain de Botton addresses the chasm between our private feelings and our real-world experiences of sex and how to think more about sex. It's one of two new books in the School of Life series, a smart and frequently funny twist on the self-help genre, which he curates. Alain de Botton is also author of the best-selling books How Proust Can Change Your Life and Religion for Atheists. The new slim volume offers consoling reminders that we are not alone with the humiliating and peculiar difficulties imposed by our sex drive, whether we're putting it to good use or not. Alain de Botton, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Don't humans think enough about sex as it is?
Well, that's the feeble joke. But in a way, we of course think about it a lot, but we get very tangled up with our thoughts on the subject. One of the most perplexing things that we have to wrestle with is the assumption that sex should be pretty easy. When we look at history, we think that our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents had problems in this area, but that's because they were, with a capital R, repressed. But fortunately, things kind of loosened up in the 60s, and ever since then, sex has meant to be pretty easy. The only difficulty might be that, you know, you don't have a date for tonight, but other than that, you know, it's a simple, uplifting, aerobic exercise, which it's hard to imagine why humanity got so bothered about for thousands of years. Now, I think that's not quite right. Sex is problematic, you know, not just here and there, not just for religions or at various moments of history. It's problematic per se. And one of the best things we can do is to take that problematic nature on board, accept it, look at it in the face, and we shouldn't feel so singled out and persecuted by it.
So for those who had the joy of sex in their living rooms, bedrooms, wherever they kept it, I guess during the late 60s or early 70s, this goes that much further?
Well, this is not a manual in the sense of getting you to have better sex like so many manuals do. I'm not suggesting ointments or positions or special pills you might be able to take to make things go better. It's in a way a very downbeat, very pessimistic book that argues that, you know, sex is going to be problematic for you. So it's deliberately, in a way, a subversion of self-help. You know, we imagine most self-help books are going to be packed full of handy, optimistic tips to have a perfect life. That's never been my way. And I imagine it as a book that you could lie in bed next to your partner, weeping softly as they're in their dreams, and you're reading this book.
In fact, you write early in the book that a useful self-help book on the subject should be a literary version of a hospice, not a hospital. So is this all about treating pain?
Yes, pretty much. Because, well, my view is if you're having great sex, you're not interested in reading books anyway. The sexually fulfilled occupy one of the small demographics of the nation that just don't go anywhere near books, and nor should they. They've got better things to do. Because what I've tried to do in the book is to write very honestly about things which, you know, perhaps we've all experienced but don't often get discussed, even in this quite liberal and, you know, supposedly open-minded period.
This you all trace, the pain surrounding sex, to the thesis of loneliness, which begins at our adolescence when we begin to develop secret selves. Tell us more about this and what that reconciliation of sex means.
Well, adolescence is traumatic for many reasons, but one of the things it of course does is it's the moment when a sex drive appears, and when that sex drive comes into conflict with all sorts of other things, other projects. The adolescent boy who, let's imagine, you know, still loves his mother and being a pleasant boy and doing well at school, etc., may suddenly develop an extremely powerful interest in pretty violent pornography, which will surprise him as much as it might surprise his mother. And the question there is, what do you do with that? How can you be sexual and still normal, nice? It's something that many, many people, too many people wrestle with, and it's one of the themes of the book.
So this intersection between our formal or public selves and our intimate selves through our sexual behavior is something that runs especially early through the book. How does this differ, then, from the way that an evolutionary biologist would describe sexual attraction and the drive to reproduce?
Well, you know, if you look at the evolutionary biologists, and they really dominate the field of writing and thinking about sex. If you ask them, you know, what is sex for? Why, you know, why is it a pleasant thing? Why do people go in for this? They'll give you one answer and one answer only. It's about procreation, and it's there to ensure that, you know, the species doesn't die out. Now, that's, you know, all well and good, but the problem is it doesn't, from a subjective point of view, explain the pleasures and the desires that sex generates. It's both true and rather boring. I hit on this side theory, that the reason why sex is pleasurable is that it's an interruption of loneliness, that most of the time we are alone. We can't touch people. We have to keep our distance from people. So much of who we are is not accepted by the world. And then once in a while, someone accepts us totally, so much so they will touch us, they will kiss us, they will do all sorts of things with us. What we call eroticism at a psychological level is proof of an end to a certain kind of loneliness. I don't know if I can mention this on your show, but one of the things I discuss in the book is oral sex. If you go to the evolutionary biologist and you say to them, why do humans do this? They'd be hard pushed to come up with an answer. But the reason I think why people find this interesting is that it's, again, an extreme confirmation of our acceptance. The dirtiest sides of us are accepted, are literally kind of blessed by somebody else.
Just noticing right now, the 50 Shades of Grey phenomenon, you know, this kind of mainstream interest and talking about erotica. Do you consider that an embrace as a kind of liberation or reconciliation of the secret self?
Well, I think, you know, what's amazing about 50 Shades of Grey phenomena is how much it was a phenomenon. So suddenly people would say, oh, you know, it's really amazing. You know, normal people have started reading pornography. And you want to say, well, really? Is this such an extraordinary event? But the fact that it is a newsworthy event suggests how much actually we're still kind of not that relaxed about the whole subject. Our self-image of the United States, Europe, is that, you know, we're very liberated countries. We're not like the Victorians. We've read Freud. We've been through all of that. And yet, it's not true. Sex is not something that we can ever easily be liberated from. There are 100 taboos that surround sex, and there will always have to be. Anyone who raises a family is immediately going to be in a sexually taboo arena. So we've got this kind of happy story that sex can just be integrated happily into life without causing any conflict. But it's just not true. It's going to remain problematic.
We're talking about sex with Alain de Botton. He is the founder of the School of Life and the author of one of the new books called How to Think About Sex. I found the chapter on pornography very funny, if not for the number of website names that you came up with as ways of wasting time. But you, in addition, call for a new kind of pornography. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think pornography is, you know, a real challenge for modern societies. What are you supposed to do about this very kind of potent force that is swallowing up many, many man hours of the nation's time? And, you know, the kind of libertarian approach is, well, don't worry, it's fine, you know. But if you speak to sex therapists and counselors, as I did, and you say to them, well, what is the number one problem that people come to you for counseling for? They will almost universally say pornography, that the internet has created pornographic addictions on a monumental scale. So what do we do about that? Well, one response is to say, you know, ban it, switch it off, make sure it's not on the airwaves, not down our fiber optic cables. Another idea that I playfully toy with in the book is to say, well, what's wrong with pornography is not that it's sexual, but that it's bad sexual, that it's demeaning. If you look at a lot of porn, which I had to do for research, it's a stunningly bad quality. In all ways, it's devoid of intelligence, of humor, of humanity. If you compare this to kind of restaurants, you know, imagine a world in which cooking was half shameful, and the only people that we abandoned cooking to never really had any training, were really kind of thoughtless about what they did and, you know, cooked in the dark corners of society, our relationship to food would be quite negative. As it is, we say, no, look, eating is a respectable part of life, and serious amounts of intelligence can be directed to making food preparation and eating go well. And that's why we've got, you know, a sophisticated food culture. We don't have a sophisticated pornographic culture because of this sense that at the end of the day, this is not something for a serious person. And, you know, why not?
You talked about what happens in a lot of long-term relationships, or a lot of them feel consigned to a paucity of sex. Are long-term marriages and relationships doomed?
Well, they're under pressure if what you're expecting is the thing that every new couple tends to expect, which is you're marrying your best friend, you're going to be running a small household business, you're going to be raising some children, and you're going to be having a fantastic sex life, and that all these things will happily coexist. Previous eras have recognized that these are very different projects. There are all sorts of competing claims within those desires, and they can't all happily coexist. So we have to prepare ourselves that something's got to go. It might be that you can't be faithful to your partner, but then you have a terrific sex life with many people, and good for you. Or it might be that you're not interested in being unfaithful, and so you'll be very faithful and lots of good things, but your sex life might suffer. In other words, there's not some ideal scenario where nothing suffers, nothing is lost. Sex within marriage is literally a tragic situation in the sense that something is lost. There is a sacrifice of something for the sake of something else. And this is a sacrifice that our society is really, really unwilling to look at in the face and accept with sadness.
So we've got this kind of daily erosion of desire, and you write, I think, so well about the tiny resentments that sort of grate us, and they're too small to even mention without sounding petty. And people begin to avoid sex in couples because it erodes our ability to actually get things done, to manage things. So some of the solutions, adding another person, checking into a hotel room, kind of seeing things with fresh eyes. Is this the way that you've added spark to long-term relationship?
Look, I think everyone's observed that strange phenomenon where hotels seem to have a really good impact on a relationship. Very often, if you're in the same place every day, that place kind of determines who you are. It fixes you according to what normally happens in that place. And if what normally happens is, you know, squabbling and administrative stuff and routine, then that will start to color how you view your partner. And I think this is one of the things that, you know, bedevils sexual relationships, which is how can you get back to seeing the other person as you saw them at the start when they were attractive to you? It's not that they've become totally unattractive, it's that you've forgotten what it was like when you found them attractive. So there's a problem of perception, and that's something you have to try and overcome.
Donne l'impression d'un petit bonhomme.
Alain de Botton, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
He addresses the chasm between our private thoughts and real-world experience of sex and how to think more about sex, one of two new books in the School of Life series. The other is Philippa Perry's How to Stay Sane. You can find out more about the School of Life and the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Latitude.